Hi, I'm Kathleen McCarthy, and you're listening to What the World Needs Now, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. I invite you to join me in this hour of God's healing power. Call and join us in conversation and prayer. Remember, what the world needs now is God, and God is love.
And good evening and welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston, and I look forward to being with you for the next hour or so. I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for all that you do for us at here at In His Sign Catholic Radio Apostolate. Your generosity and your prayers have kept us on the air. I think I heard Kathleen say yesterday, almost 45 years, and we just continue to ask that you do what you can in order to allow us to bring you great shows like today's. Without any further ado, we are blessed to be joined today by Dan Leroy. And Dan is an author, journalist, and teacher who has been the director of the writing and publishing department at Lincoln Park Performing Arts Charter School in Midland, Pennsylvania since 2006. His writing about music and politics has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Newsweek, The Village Voice, Alternative Press, Esquire.com, and National Review Online. And Dan, that's from the bio that Sophia sent, Sophia Institute sent over to us. But I love the line that's in the book, and he is certainly the only person in history to have contributed to publications founded by William F. Buckley Jr. and by Gene Simmons of KISS. So So Dan Leroy, it's great to have you with us. The book we're going to talk about today is Liberty's Lions: The Catholic Revolutionaries Who Established America, published by Sophia Institute Press. So should be available most of the big bookstores, but certainly through you can get it through our Catholic stores here in the Philadelphia area. And I looked up the school today, Dan, and it looks like you're right on the border there of Pennsylvania and Ohio, a little northwest of Pittsburgh.
That's correct. Yeah. That is correct.
Yeah, so we're here on the opposite side of the state in Philadelphia, and so there's even a whole chapter in the book dedicated to Philadelphia and what was going on here. So I think our listeners are going to be interested in what we talk about today. So thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for having me on the show. Certainly a great pleasure. And like you say, Philadelphia in a lot of ways is kind of ground zero for this story. So it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to somebody representing that great city.
Thank you. I hope you feel that's the same way during football season and hockey season and the great rivalries we have here with Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. But now the feeling's absolutely mutual, Dan. So thanks for being with us. I only had a few seconds to talk to you before we came on, and I told you that I picked up the book the Sophia Institute was kind enough to send an advanced copy, and a lot of times I don't get to read them, and but I picked this one up because I do have an interest. And right off the bat, there's information in here that I had never learned about. And you know, you start the book off by talking about the little revolt that went on down in South Carolina. And, you know, I had no idea, this Stono River slave rebellion. And I'll be honest, I had no idea that a single slave was Catholic. And to learn right off the bat.
I don't think a lot of people do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I found it interesting right off the bat, and it kind of hooked me from the get-go here.
Well, thank you for saying that. And that was kind of the thinking that here's a chapter in a book that I think has a lot of stuff that people either don't know or gets glossed over, and how can we start it in a way that kind of sets the stage for what is to come? And it so happens that slave revolt, which happened in 1739 and was the only major slave revolt in the colonies up to the time of the Revolution, just so happens that it does have that Catholic element to it, as you say. And so it kind of, I hoped that it would make kind of an arresting opener. You know, the other reason for doing that is that as it says somewhere early on, you know, Catholicism and slavery are two institutions that kind of have a conjoined history throughout this era. And it's a pretty complicated one, as we can all imagine. And it also seemed to be right to start the book with this particular chapter just because of that conjoined history. So I'm glad that it drew you in.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that there's so much that people don't know. And so there's actually a whole chapter in the book, chapter 4, that talks about the Philadelphia story. And and we may skip around a little bit here, but you know, in the Philadelphia story, as many times as I've been to the Center City, I have never been to Old St. Joseph's, and I have never heard about, you know, the Jesuit founder who didn't even dress as a priest, but would dress as a Quaker in order to fly under the radar. You know, and I think about, you know, I think in every era. Since the beginning of time, there's always been some group that got persecuted, and I think some groups think that they're the only group that's ever been persecuted. And, you know, it just shows, you know, what was going on at the time with the Catholics, not only in Philadelphia, but throughout the colonies. And of course it goes back to Europe, but that, we almost feel like we've never heard these things. That, you know, people have always thought the Catholic Church, everybody knew about it. It was always accepted, and it was not accepted here in the colonies, was it?
It really wasn't. Yeah, I think one of the things you mentioned, Philadelphia and Old St. Joseph's, and one of the things that still amazes me is that Old St. Joseph's and right down the street, Old St. Mary's, these were the only two places in the entire British Empire where, up until the Revolutionary War, where you could attend a public mass. There wasn't any place else where you could do it. There were definitely places where mass was celebrated, but it was done secretly. It was done covertly. It was done by these circuit-riding priests. Philadelphia had one of the greatest of those, Father Ferdinand Farmer. One of those Jesuits you were just mentioning. But as far as actually being able to attend a publicly celebrated mass, like, those two places were it everywhere. And the British Empire at that time was fairly substantial. So it's really an amazing thing when you think about the place that Catholics held in the British Empire. And as you mentioned, that persecution didn't come from nowhere. It came from Europe. It came from England. And I think it's a pretty telling thing when you think that in colonial America, the time that we're talking about, Catholics made up less than 2% of the population. We're talking about 24 to 30,000 colonial Catholics. But then you think that's double the percentage, at least, although we're talking about different numbers, but that's double the percentage of people who were declared Catholics in England at this time, which was something like 1%. So, and that was a pretty big historical reversal, of course, over centuries. But it just gives you an idea. You know, today people say, well, there's a Catholic president, there are Catholic Supreme Court justices, and the Catholic Church is still the biggest denomination. So people, as you pointed out, don't really remember that it hasn't been all that long ago that the Church was not only a minority, but a persecuted minority here in America.
Yeah, and, you know, so like you say, it was hard for me to believe that it was actually those numbers. You think of the Puritans, I guess, were the originals that were looking to get out of the persecution in England, and we certainly hear about them. But I would have thought that there would have been far more of a Catholic presence early on, especially in light of the number of missionaries that would come, and I guess for the most part they were maybe south of the colonies in Florida and north of us in Canada.
In Canada?
Yep.
And to the west of us in the Louisiana Territory and all up and down the Mississippi. That's the thing, you know, I think, is we're so Eastern-centric in the way that we look at this year. And it's understandable because the original 13 colonies, of course, were where they were. But all around us, as you say, there is this Catholic presence. And it's just a Catholic presence that's kind of gotten written out of the history books because of the way, again, that we focus on this fairly small patch of territory. Yet when it comes to the Revolutionary War, the things that happen in these other places, all surrounding us to the north, to the south, and especially to the west, the stuff that happens there is what really sets the stage for the history that we're familiar with, that happened back east, all of these battles that, you know, we know pretty well. If not for what happens in these other territories, those battles probably don't turn out the way that we're coached into understanding them. So,
yeah, so obviously you have great knowledge of all of this. I'm just curious as to where that came from. When did you first start to learn about this, and when did it draw your interest in to the point where this great book has come from it?
Well, it's a great question, and I'm fortunate in a couple ways. One of the ways that I'm really, really fortunate, and fortunate in a way that sadly I think less and less people are fortunate, and I say that as somebody whose day job is teaching some of these young people. Now, I grew up in a household where literature was important, and so was history. Knowing where you came from and knowing how one thing led to another. My mom was and is a great genealogist, and it was impressed upon my brother and I very early on that, you know, history is an important thing. We don't get where we are from nowhere, that all of this stuff is important. So I never had that thing that you hear a lot of people say about history and increasingly hear them say that, which is, hey, what's this have to do with me? Like, why are you telling me this? What does this have to do with my life? So I was really lucky there. And another way that I was lucky that I probably wouldn't have appreciated at the time is I was born baptized Catholic, but I didn't come back to the faith until I was an adult. And for me, that was probably a pretty lucky thing because I think it allowed me to appreciate it in a way that maybe I wouldn't have had I spent my entire childhood and young adulthood in the church. When I came back to it, it was because I wanted to come back to it because I realized that it was important, and I had, you know, made the decision that, you know, I guess for lack of a better way of saying it, I had sampled at least one other alternative and kind of found it wanting. And so when I came back to the church, it was because it was something that I knew was missing and was really important to me. So I like to think that my appreciation of this part of history comes from both those places. And then the third really fortunate thing that I just kind of lucked into is the parish, or the two parishes actually, where I have spent the last 10 years. They're run by a great set of priests, a bunch of guys who are really kind of swimming against the tide of modernity and are really trying to go back to basics, to the things that are important. And I guess that's really a way that this book, a thing that helped it emerge, is the idea for it came spending time in a thing that our parish has that we're very fortunate to have, which is a perpetual adoration chapel. That's really where the seed of this whole thing came, is sitting in chapel on a Sunday evening and reading a piece in Magnificat about colonial Catholics. And the author of the piece mentioned you know, hey, there are actually several colonial Catholics who were important. And I don't know if I really knew that fully, but I went looking for the book that would tell me more about this, and there wasn't one. So I guess I set out to write it, and I hope that's what I've done.
No, and from the little that I've read so far, and I know that this is one of the books, so this is a weekly show, Dan, and most weeks I have authors on that have written other great books, and I have limited time, and so often I don't get through them, but this one has really piqued my interest, and because, like I said, there's so much in here that I wasn't aware of. And I think a lot of people have probably heard of the Carrolls, especially the Archbishop in Maryland. And because it's called the State of Maryland, and supposedly for, or at least I think a lot of us assume it's the Blessed Mother, that there was always religious freedom in Maryland. And then I read today where, you know, the priests actually had to take an oath that they did not believe in transubstantiation. And that, you know, Mass there was shut down as well. And like you said, the only place that it was being publicly celebrated was right here in Philadelphia. And I think even then, I don't know, I understand it was publicly celebrated in that there was a gathering, there was a church where people would gather for Mass. But I don't think necessarily that it was public. I don't think they were hanging billboards on the corner saying, come to Mass this Sunday, you know, we're having a fish fry after, or we're having coffee and tea and donuts, that even the people that went, it may have been, at least in the beginning, by invitation only, and they kind of try to keep it under the rest of the town's radar.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, these two colonies, Pennsylvania and Maryland, are really good examples of, you know, the limits of religious freedom in America. Pennsylvania is founded, as everybody knows, or I think everybody knows, by William Penn. And, you know, the charter for Philadelphia is thought to be kind of a model for this exercise of religious freedom. But the truth of it is, William Penn himself, I don't think, was always completely sympathetic to Catholics. His son, who took over, I think definitely wasn't. And, you know, William Penn at various times faced some heat back in England for some of these activities that Catholics got up to in his colony. And, you know, religious liberty is written into the charter. Sometimes it exists, but a lot of times when it exists, and I think you kind of gave a good description of it there a minute ago, it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell kind of thing. You're going to have Mass. You're going to open a Jesuit school. Just make sure that nobody really knows about this stuff, because if they know about it, then we're going to run into problems. And I think that was really the case right up into, you know, the Revolutionary War, which did have the effect of changing some of this. Maryland is an even, I think, more striking proposition. This is a colony that is, you know, founded explicitly on the promise of religious freedom, and the founder is Catholic, and yet even on the two boats that come over carrying the first settlers, Catholics are already outnumbered. And what happens over the next 125, 150 years is an example of what we're just saying. Sometimes things are okay for Catholics, and then other times really means like the majority of the 18th century, other times it's not so good. They can't vote. They can't hold public office. They may have a lot of money, like the Carrolls did, but even if you have a lot of money, you're still a second-class citizen all the way. And, you know, even if you want to send your kids, I think one of the most amazing examples of, you know, how Catholics were viewed by their fellow colonists is, if you want to get your kids a good Catholic education, that probably means you're going to have to send them overseas, because there really isn't any place like that in the colonies yet. So you put your kid 9, 10, 11 years old on a ship to make a very, very dangerous sea crossing. You may never see him again. And to do all this, to go to these lengths, to get your child a Catholic education, to do this, you got to pay an exorbitant tax, something like £100, just for the privilege of putting your kid on a ship where you may never get to see them again. So when we talk about Catholics having to undergo some privations in this period, there's a little example of what we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think it's another one of those sections that's highlighted right in the beginning of the book, and I had never heard of Pope's Day, right, November the 5th. And, you know, we don't want to give away everything in the book. I really encourage people to go out and pick this up. I think it's a very important book. But, you know, when I read about what went on in Boston on Pope's Day, it's one of those things I don't think anybody has ever heard of. I actually sent text messages to a few friends today. You know, have you ever heard of this? And to a person, and these are devout Catholics, you know, and they'd never heard of it. And so I know of at least a few people that I think two of them already got the book today.
Wow.
And others will.
Well, you know, Pope's Night, it sounds like a fun Catholic activity, except it's kind of the opposite.
Yeah. And I guess because we're so far removed, and I think that, I guess it's like anything in life. When you don't experience it personally, and you only have your own experience, and you think back to, you know, 100 years ago and no plumbing, or 200 years ago and no electricity, and I think those things, it's like, oh yeah, I understand that. Things have moved forward. But when we talk about, you know, people's individual lives and the fact that I can get up every morning and go to daily mass, or I can get up every day and find an adoration chapel that's open and spend time with our Lord. And to think that there was a time where that didn't exist. And even in my own country that, you know, we claim is the land of the free, home of the brave. And yet, like you said, for many people, they weren't all that free. And so to come to know this, it makes me appreciate even more the characters that you outline in the book, and the courage it took to do some of the things that they did in order to help found this great country.
Well, I have to say, just on that note, that writing the book, and I did spend a good amount of last year working on it, you know, writing it during the pandemic when churches are closed, when you can't attend Mass, when Easter is kind of a washout, when you have all these things that you were just mentioning suddenly taken away, it gave me a little bit of a window into, you know, what some of these folks went through and the courage that it must have taken for them to maintain their faith in the face of, in some cases we're talking about the same kind of thing, government intervention that is keeping them from enacting their faith in the way that they would choose. So it's, in one sense, no, it's not the same thing at all, but you know, there was something about writing this, again, during Lent last year, when everybody's trying to figure out, hey, is my church going to be able to offer this stuff through Facebook or through YouTube? And if they don't, then where am I going to go? Yeah, it was a bit of a wake-up call, I got to say.
Yeah. No, and we do a show before this one with a good friend of mine, Father Doug McKay, and we often talk with folks, and we're always talking about our phrase, is that odd or is that God, that, you know, that there are no coincidences in life. And, you know, the idea that at that one moment in time, where you happen to read that in the Magnificat, and I would imagine, well, I'm not sure exactly what the timeline is, but then to sit down and decide to write this book, and all of a sudden the pandemic comes on us, and you know, I'm just thinking, is that odd or is that God that you were able to put those two things together? You know, you could have, you know, this could have happened 5 years ago, or God could have waited 5 years from now to inspire you to write the book, and yet he did it at almost the perfect time for you to really get a grasp of what it may have been like for them. So,
I'm with you. I'm with you. Okay. It's God a lot more often than it's odd.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So when you started to do the research, and I had mentioned to you that we'd take a break at the bottom of the hour, when we may have to take a break in the middle of this. But as you were doing your research and what have you, were there any particular people that you really found more exciting or what have you than others? Is there somebody that really stands out at this time that more than some of the other characters that you talk about in the book?
The nice thing is that there are a lot of folks in the book whose stories were, you know, they weren't much more than names to me, and I'd run across them. But I really, when I started this, there was a lot that I didn't know about just about everybody in the book. But to answer the question, there really is one character, and that is Adrienne de Lafayette, the Marquis de Lafayette's wife. You know, on the one hand, she's not a revolutionary. She never set foot on American soil, like I believe it says. And you could make the case for, you know, what's she doing in this book? And what she's doing in the book is, she is such an amazing character, and she's somebody that I really didn't know much of anything about. Her faith, I think, maybe more so than anybody else in the book, and you have some people who had pretty serious faith, her faith, I think, is heroic, not just for some of the things that she went through in her own life, but for the way that she tried to win her husband, who, by his own admission, was not a great Catholic, not a great Christian, tried to win him back to the faith. And she kept trying to do that right up into, you know, her time on her deathbed. Was she successful? You know, that might be one of those things we got to find out in the next life. But if she wasn't successful, it's certainly not for any lack of effort on her part. And she really, Lafayette, again, was not a devout Catholic nor a devout Christian, and yet he was really moved by his wife's efforts, and he did take them seriously. How seriously? Again, that's a question probably above all our pay grade. But she's just an amazing, amazing character, and she's somebody, again, that I think most people really don't know anything about. I didn't, and I can't do anything but admire her after learning about her and getting the chance to write about her in this book.
Now, that's awesome. Again, our guest is Dan Leroy, and the book we're talking about is Liberty's Lions, The Catholic Revolutionaries Who Established America, published by Sophia Institute Press, available at the big bookstores online, but certainly can be gotten through the local Catholic shops here in the Philadelphia area. I mentioned, Dan, we take a break at the bottom of the hour, and we've arrived there, so we're just going to take a short break. If you don't mind, I'd love to hold you over. If you have the time.
I'm having fun, so let's do it.
All right, pal. For our listeners, the break's going to be short. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
My name is Mario Diadamo, and I have been a faithful listener to Inner Sign Radio Ministry since 1990 and to Kathleen McCarthy as principal host since 2007. Hearing the witness of Kathleen and her guests has contributed greatly to my spiritual growth. They have educated me about the tenets of my Catholic faith by presenting lay and religious leaders discuss topics that help listeners create an informed Catholic conscience. I always encourage people who are in need of prayer and companionship to listen, call in, and become part of our radio listener family by joining thousands of other people praying for your intentions. I personally can attest to the power of the prayers from the ministry. Kathleen often reminds her listeners that you are never alone because the Lord is always with us. Through this Catholic radio and internet apostolate, the Lord is indeed with us in a very tangible way. Please share the good news as Kathleen takes a leap of faith and expanding to a two-hour program to reach many more people who need to experience the love of God. Thank you.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610-527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. Your host, Ken Johnston. And again, I'm delighted to have you with us, our great listeners whose prayers and financial support has kept us on the air for some 45 years. And again, we can't thank you enough for all that you do for us and help us to make that happen. And allows you to bring you great shows like today's. Just a reminder that out at our website at inhissign.com, you can catch podcasts, we call them, but they're actually recordings of all the shows. You can find them by going to inhissign.com, click on content, and then podcasts. And we're about a week behind right now, but we should be caught up by the end of this week, including today's show. So if you missed any portion of it, you'll be able to come back and listen once again. Our guest today is Dan Leroy, and we're talking about his book, Liberty's Lions, The Catholic Revolutionaries Who Established America. And I've probably said it a half dozen times in the first segment that there's many things in here that most, including Dan himself, were not aware of until he undertook to write this book. And so there's much to be learned about our colonial history, and especially the persecution, if you will, of Catholics that made their way to America prior to the American Revolution. So, again, Dan, thanks for your efforts in putting the book together, and thanks for hanging out for another segment. I certainly appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, the role of the Catholic faith and the characters that you talked about, you know, you mentioned Lafayette and his wife, and a couple other, I guess there were some Polish patriots, and you talk about the Black Madonna, and even today, my in-laws that are here from Dayton, Ohio, so they passed through your area last week when they were headed to this area. My brother-in-law right now is at Our Lady of Częstochowa, a shrine here outside the Philadelphia area, which will be home of a replica, of course, of the Black Madonna. And, I remember years ago walking through Center City with my wife, and we found a house where a gentleman lived by the name of Thaddeus Kosciuszko. And I'll be honest, I didn't read the chapter yet on Polish patriots, so I don't know if he's mentioned by name. But
he is.
Very good. So, you know, one more thing I'm looking forward to in here. But just in the first couple pages here on the Polish patriots, you know, right away that this idea that the Pulaski character, Kazimierz Pulaski, is praying before the Black Madonna. So the role that the faith played in some of these individuals who I guess at some point really did put their faith and their life on the line in order to bring about the change that would come with the revolution. And maybe there was something, I don't know if there was a common thread through some of these characters that you picked up on, or, you know, what may have motivated them as part of their faith to do some of the things they did to help in the revolution.
That's a really good question. And, you know, some of those common threads are probably things that don't always show up in the box score, as they say, as far as the motivations of some of these folks. But personal motivations aside, I think if you put those Polish patriots that you just mentioned, Kazimierz Pulaski and Thaddeus Kosciuszko, who did spend some time there in Philadelphia, and the place where he stayed, which where he was visited by, among other folks, Thomas Jefferson, is right there in the old part of the city. I was unable to visit it, sadly, because of COVID, like we were talking about earlier. But one of these days I'm going to come back and get a better look. But anyway, the Polish patriots, if you combine them with all of these foreign soldiers who really, if we're being honest, the foreign soldiers are the ones who tip the balance in favor of independence. You know, there's a quote that's mentioned in the book somewhere early on, I think, from Alexander Hamilton. And Hamilton is one of the founders who, he's not too terribly sympathetic to Catholics. He's on record several times with some fairly anti-Catholic sentiments. But it's 1780. We're very late in the war. The war really hangs in the balance. It's anybody's ball game. But it's at a moment where things look particularly bleak for the Patriot side. And Hamilton writes in a letter, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's a pretty close paraphrase, "Oh God, if we're going to be saved, France and Spain are going to have to save us." And Hamilton was right. That's what it took, and that is ultimately what did it. And the thing, the common thread, I guess, if you will, that these French soldiers, that Spanish soldiers, that the Polish patriots, that some of the German folks who fought on the patriot side, some of the Irish folks, the common thread is their Catholicism. And, you know, one of the, to go back to an earlier point in the discussion, one of the reasons I think that Catholic contributions in this era have gotten short shrift is it's really just by the numbers. And we were saying earlier that we're talking about something like 24,000 to 30,000 colonial Catholics, and not all of them were patriots. So that's a number that's less than 2% of the colonial population at the time. And on that basis, it's pretty easy to see why people might conclude, yeah, Catholics, what did they really contribute? Among those 24,000 to 30,000 patriots or Catholic patriots, though, are, you know, some of the most integral figures in the revolution. But once you get past that little number of people and you add in all the contributions of these foreign soldiers, most of whom are Catholic, you can see the potential relevance of a number, which I've read in a few places. I don't know if we'll ever be able to verify it, but there are some estimates that as many as 70% of the soldiers who fought on the Patriot side during the revolution were Catholic. And that is mostly because of these foreign Catholics, again, the French, the Polish, the Germans, the Spanish, the Irish. Those are the numbers that really kind of put that idea of Catholic contributions in a completely different context than we're used to hearing. So that's a long-winded way of answering the question that doesn't exactly answer the question, but the common thread really is the Catholicism of these foreign soldiers, which, you know, even today, in 2021, with all of the history that we have behind us, that's still a thing that I think the lay person doesn't really give enough credit to, how important these foreign contributions were to our independence. As heroic as the homegrown colonial patriots were, we don't get there without these other contributions, and they're largely contributions from Catholics.
Yeah, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, in my quick perusal, it was the most important receipt in American history, is the chapter there, and I think the number I read was it'd be equivalent to $3 billion today that the French, gave us, not in cash obviously, but in supplies and military aid, and that's an astounding number, and. So does this, I guess, go back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show, where, you know, I was always under the impression that there were a lot more Catholics here than there were, but the Catholic influence was really around the colonies, northwest and south of us. So was it through them that Spain and France get involved, or was it a direct request from maybe the non-Catholics that had gotten this thing rolling that went to Spain and France to solicit help?
It's a little bit of both. And we should probably point out that France in particular, France has a very vested interest in being involved. And a lot of that is through the foreign minister, Vergennes, who, you know, he's a guy who remembers very well the lessons of the 7 Years' War. France comes out on the losing side, and you know, the French have kind of lain in the weeds for a long time after that, waiting for their opportunity. But they don't want to get involved overtly at first, so that most important receipt in American history that you talked about is through the efforts of a guy who gets a chapter in this book, the playwright Beaumarchais, who sets up this dummy corporation that funnels a lot of these arms and supplies to the colonies. And they make a big difference. In fact, one of the, I think you would say this reaches the level of historical irony. The French don't want to get involved overtly until they can be sure that the colonies can actually pull their own weight. And they're waiting for a significant battle to show that this can happen. The battle that kind of swings things in the colonists' favor is at Saratoga in 1777. But the ironic part of it is that this battle is not won without all of these arms and supplies that have been sent covertly by the French. So it's kind of a circular argument, if you will. The French supply the arms covertly, and then when the colonists use those arms to win a significant battle, the French say, well, okay, now we can actually get involved overtly. And Spain had to stay out of it for other reasons, a big reason being that they had two very important shipments coming over from North America that they did not want to take a chance on having captured by the British, by their getting involved again overtly in the war too early. So Spain also does a lot of covert supplying of the colonial forces. So to, I guess, go back to the question, because I kind of circled a ways away from it, a good example of this involvement that we're talking about that happens on the borders of the colonies comes in the West. And there's a Catholic financier who's mentioned in Liberty's Lions. He doesn't get a lot of ink there. His name is Oliver Pollack, and he's a businessman, and he is a big, big part of the fundraising effort that goes on the Western frontier. And he is helping to supply troops up and down the Mississippi. He's helping to supply troops that are in Spanish Florida. And again, without those contributions, the battles that we know that happened back east that we're familiar with, leading all the way up to Yorktown, those battles don't go the way, probably, that we know that they went. What happens in the West has a very direct effect on what happens back east. It's just that in our history books, we tend to know what happened back east without knowing how the western part of this, which tends to be a pretty heavily Catholic part of this, we don't know how the one influenced the other, but it most definitely did.
Very good. And I'm just learning fact after fact as a result of this conversation, Dan, and I really do appreciate it. So where I'm sitting right now at this moment is probably 15 minutes drive, if there's no traffic, from Valley Forge, and probably, you know, at least for us locally, and I guess anybody that really studied the American Revolution, you know, you read about Washington's encampment there prior to the final battles and what have you, and that you know, what was going on there in terms of lack of food and sickness and what have you. And you dedicate a chapter there to Washington. And I was disappointed to learn that that I guess you would call it an apparition, wasn't real. But but the role, again, the name of the chapter is The Greatest Catholic That Ever Was, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously everybody knows that Washington played a significant role in the Revolution, but in your research and in your writing, maybe just a few minutes on your take on Washington.
Well, the vision that you mentioned, which did allegedly happen at Valley Forge, there really isn't a lot of evidence to suggest that it was authentic, but I stop short of saying that there's no way it's been debunked, because one of the things that's surprising about that vision, you know, the story about it is that it was actually something that was cooked up by a writer during the Civil War. So, you know, the better part of 100 years after it allegedly happened. And that's probably the case, but, you know, there's still a kind of nagging thing, which is that this vision, which a lot of people have told and retold that story over the years without maybe knowing, you know, where it originated, the thing that does kind of strike you is that there are some pretty amazing similarities to what is mentioned in this vision and what happens at Fatima. And, of course, Fatima doesn't happen until, you know, something like 65, 70 years after this story is alleged to have been cooked up. So the evidence doesn't really show that it happened in the place and at the time it happened, but I don't want to write it off completely just yet. You know,
yeah.
Like you were saying earlier, is it odd or is it God? I don't want to go completely in the realm of the skeptics just yet there, because there are some pretty striking similarities. But be that as it may, the one thing that I think really isn't in question is that Washington, you know, I'll say it this way, and it sounds like a surprising thing to say about the father of your country. I think in researching this chapter and in researching what Washington meant, not just to Catholics, but to Catholics in the context of what he meant to everybody. Now, Washington's a guy I still think is underrated. What Washington did that none of the other founders really was able to do was speak to Catholics in a way that felt authentic. And if you're looking at all the founders on a continuum, you have some guys who are pretty profoundly anti-Catholic. And you have some guys in the middle who are skeptical. They really don't understand it. And then if you keep moving along the line, you have somebody like Benjamin Franklin, who I think is skeptical, but is also smart enough to be circumspect and doesn't air a lot of his, whatever his true beliefs about Catholicism might have been. But Washington kind of stands alone at the other side of this continuum. Washington is a guy, just to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, when he takes over as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army in 1775, one of the first things he does is he looks at this Pope's Night celebration, which is going on every November 5th, and says, hey, look, we're going to put a stop to this right now because we cannot ask our countrymen who are Catholic, we can't ask them to join our cause when we're publicly insulting them in this way. And he does stop it. And Catholics always remember that Washington's a guy who doesn't just talk the talk. He also walks the walk. And for that reason, and for some others, it's probably not surprising that Catholics have tried for a long time to claim Washington. I wouldn't go so far as to say that there's a basis for that. Again, the evidence is a little bit thin on the ground. But what I do think there is evidence that does support is that, you know, this idea that Washington was a very disinterested deist who didn't really have any particular religious beliefs at all. I don't think that's true. I think there's actually a lot of evidence that suggests that he was a much more serious Christian than he has often been given credit for. And out of that seriousness, I think, came his attitude toward Catholics, which, again, made him a very, very special and significant figure in their eyes and continues to do so today.
I certainly appreciate the information because, again, this is one more reason for folks to pick up the book and learn more about a number of the founders and those Catholics that had a great influence on the founding of this country. Again, our guest today has been Dan Leroy, and we've been talking about Liberty's Lions, the Catholic revolutionaries who established America. And, you know, as we're talking, Dan, and you mentioned that because of the pandemic, you weren't able to visit some of these places here in Philadelphia that are mentioned throughout the book. I'm just thinking in the back of my mind that I would love someday that when you come that we get together. I think that there's a host of people that would be interested in learning more, and maybe we I would love to tour some of these places with you and maybe put something together an evening where we can gather some people together and talk about this.
Hey, that sounds like a bet.
Yeah, man.
I would love to do that.
Okay. I got your email address that came across, and I think Harry, our producer, may have been in touch with you. But I will be in touch, and I would love to put something together at some point.
That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. Absolutely.
And a lot of it is walkable. You know, there might be some places that would be outside the bounds of that, but, you know, there's a good section where you can hit a lot of these very significant sites, and they're not that far apart. So it'd be like a ghost tour.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. We'll bill it as that, the Catholic Ghost Tour
of
Colonial Philadelphia.
I like it.
Yeah, yeah. But, listen, when I a lot of times I'll get the paperwork for who's coming on, and it'll say that they're only scheduled for 30 minutes, and sometimes, you know, folks are busy and can only stay the 30. So I really appreciate you staying for the whole hour. I think it was beneficial to our listeners. I encourage them all to go out and pick up a copy of this book and really learn about the history of our country, and especially from the Catholic perspective, and especially in this cancel culture where, you know, we don't want to talk about necessarily how the country was founded and what it was based on and what have you. I think, again, it's not odd. It's God that this book has come out when it has, And so go out and grab a copy. Dan, again, I can't thank you enough for spending the hour. It's been a joy to have you with us, and I appreciate all the information.
Well, likewise. Hey, look, when a guy who talks as slowly as I do gets a chance to take the full hour, he has to take it. But I also just want to, before I go, let listeners know that, as you mentioned, you can get this book from the publisher at SophieInstitute.com and all the major online retailers, and certainly at your local Catholic bookstore, which would be great to support. If anyone wants a signed copy, they can go to my website, which is Dan Leroy. That's LEROY.com. I'll be happy to sign one up and ship it out to wherever you want it.
Beautiful. Again, it's Dan Leroy, LEROY.com. And that's a great offer. So especially with Father's Day around the corner, you may not be able to, Dan may not be able to get it to you in time for Father's Day. But go out to Amazon or somewhere and snap a copy of the cover and slip it in the card and let them know that the signed copy is coming, huh?
Hey, there you go.
Yeah,
I like how you think.
Yeah. Well, Dan, thank you again. It's been a great day. Are you a father by chance?
I am a father. I'm a father of three, a very proud father of three. My youngest son just graduated from high school last week, so I'm about to be a proud father of three and empty nester as well.
Good for you. Happy Father's Day to you. I hope you have a great Father's Day weekend and spend time with those kids.
Well, thank you so much, Ken. Thank you for having me on. It's certainly been my complete pleasure. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I'll look forward to coming over there sometime and touring around with you.
Very good. I'll be in touch.
All right.
All right, Dan. Thanks so much. God bless you.
Thank you. God bless you as well.
All righty. So another great hour, and the hour flew, and I was I shot a text message to my buddy Paul on my way over here, and you know, if you've been listening to this show or the show with Father McKay and I, you know a little bit about my background, and I've got I think it's right around 50 days left with my full time gig before I retire and go to work with Father McKay full time, and so I don't have. Often have the time to delve into all these books. And I sent my buddy Paul a text message as I was coming over here today that I really wish I had read more of this before I had Dan on the air, but he did a great job and certainly appreciate it. And I look forward to reading the rest of it. So our time is short, and I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Thank you again for all that you do for us here at In His Sign. Thank you, Joe, for making sure we got out, even with the little technical difficulty at the very beginning. We certainly appreciate it. So for all of our listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week. Until then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care, and God bless.